High Libertine, Chapter 3. The night had not been cool, and the morning was most unseasonable. Lance woke to an unwanted drone of flies and an almost invisible reek from the stables directly below. His nostrils twitched, and he cursed and opened his eyes. He closed them again immediately. Daylight. Even the dimmest and earliest is no friend to such a cramped, corroded, noisome closet as this. A single candle had been enough, and more than enough for it. At the thought of a candle, he looked at it, and spent and spilled its leaden holder, and then his gaze slid to the tip-crazy chair, half-turned from the littered table, just as she had left it, coming to him. He rolled out of bed and approached it, hearing the drums again, faintly. He turned up the mirror, for a mad moment thinking he might see her face in it again, the coppered shadows and the hollows of her shoulders. He laughed then, perhaps at himself, yet a little fondly. Well, he laughed fondly at himself, and then began to dress. He dressed carefully in dun-colored hose and heavy, dull shoes with one small pewter buckle each. His linen was clean and very white, but decently frayed. His tuck-waisted coat, not too snug, and slightly wrinkled. He folded his linen of the night before and the gorgeous waistcoat, and with the burnished civil buckles, the rich hose and coat, and put them in the chest. It was camphor wood, carefully laid in a shell of battered oak. Like himself, it looked like a thousand others outside, and within concealed its virtues. He locked its two heavy locks with two separate keys from his ring, and then glanced around the room, disgusted at once. It could now be opened to chambermaid and prying innkeeper, and be damned to them. They might keep anything they could move. He took up the Courtney coach escutcheon, wagged his head admiringly, and set it carefully in the large inside pocket of his coat. He put on the slouched hat, taking care to knock out the last signs of its ever having been tricorned and cockaded, and took up his rough thorn-wood stick, and descended the stairs. Grove, the innkeeper, stood in the court, and by his very presence drawing flies from the stable.
"Hey! Good morrow, Master Lanky!"
Lance gave him the briefest of nods, but Grove was not dismissed.
"A word, sir!"
The sir was not lost on Lance, who was quite used to it, and satisfied with Grove's usual form of address, which was no form at all.
"Be quick, then," he said coldly, sensing an advantage. "I've a little to say, sir, though 'tis with all my heart. It might be. I've been a mite hard on ye, sir, one time or another, for ye reckon, and then that. I wanted ye to know, I might note. A nin's a pesky thing to deal with, and keeps a body half balmy, they might say. So, for anything I might have said in times of past, I beg your humble pardon."
"How much did she give you, Grove? A gold sovereign?"
Lance snapped. Grove cringed, which was a sizable feat for a man of his girth.
"I didn't want you angry with me, sir, and I had to be sure. I'll not let a stranger into your rooms, not for—"
"Not for less than a shilling,"
said Lance acidly. He raised the ferrule of his stick and tapped Grove with the bristly point of his chin.
"It's all right this time, but see to it that whatever she bribed you with has purchased your deafness.
Rap.
Blindness. Rap. And a total loss of memory. Rap."
"Oh, I, sir, she did, and she has the very thing I was about to say, sir."
He stumbled back from the stick and went blinking and wheezing, ogling and giggling into the shadows of the stable.
"Old swine," Lance thought. "I wonder just how much she did give him."
He strode smartly down to Abbey Street, and along it not quite to the Jamaica Road.
keeping close to the center kennel all the way. For though the unusual weather was raising a proper summer flavor from this waterway, it was safer than by the house fronts and their overhanging first stories. He came at last to the dangling, legless, tailless horse which marked the saddlery, and turned into the alehouse next to it.
"Hey there, Mr. Eager Piggott!"
"Good morrow, Mother Starch."
He did not, as did most people, respond to her warm, wide smile and ardent little voice. He learned years ago that her features relaxed into this delighted expression, and her diction followed suit, regardless of her feelings.
"And how is poor dear Mr. Barrowbridge to die?"
She beamed.
"I haven't been up there yet," Lad said. "Do you have a loaf for us this morning?"
"Oh, then I have, and me sister's husband rode up from Ether Green last night and brought me plover's eggs if you'd like some."
"I would want that. 4, if you have them."
"You can have 6. They're right soothing for poor dear Mr. Barrowbridge's affliction. Fair rotten away he is. My Uncle Neddy had the same complaint. When their voices go like that, they're done for, you may depend,"
she said happily.
"Next thing to look for is a horrid great hole opening on the side of the neck here,"
she went on, touching her throat.
"After that it might drag on for a year or more, but it's all over with him."
She gave him a luminous smile.
"You have tea?"
"Thank you, no," said Lance,
taking some comfort in the fact that Uncle Neddy had not been carried off by leprosy. "But I'll have some fresh water from your cistern. Is Scuttle about?"
"Scuttle!"
she yodeled, the 2 syllables an octave apart. From the shadows of the alehouse came a frightening scrabbling as if of startled rodents, and an undersized 8-year-old boy appeared.
"Is that nice, Mr. Eager Piggott? What on a word with ye?"
The boy looked at the nice Mr. Eager Piggott without enthusiasm. Lance sat down on a heel and crossed his forearms on the other extended knee, attempting to look friendly. The boy backed away. Lance said,
"Have you been up to the offices yet, Scuttle?"
"No, sir, but I'll hurry on."
"Did you know there was a new gypsy caravan in Southwark Park?"
"Please, sir, yes, but I shan't."
"Would you run down there and see if you caught?"
"Oh, sir, I'd never."
"With a silver 3 pence you wouldn't?"
Scuttle stared at him, and the 3-penny bit, dumbfounded. The young barrister's clerk had not the reputation of extending money, not even to tease. Lance smiled glassily.
"We'll not be needing you at all today. We'll have to be very quiet and work hard and not see anyone. Here, take this lad and push off."
"Oh!"
breathed the child.
"Now,"
said Mother Starch chidingly,
"a clout in the ear be better. Give us the 3 pence to keep for ye, boy." "Fine chance,"
said Scuttle courteously, and disappeared into Abbey Street.
"Oh, well,"
said Mother Starch cheerfully,
"mayhap the gypsies will steal him,"
she hummed as she took up the eggs carefully in an end of a rough sacking and handed him the twisted end.
"Oh, step up and empty your slops later on, sir."
"Thank you, no," said Lance. "What I can't do can wait. Just put these things on Mr. Barrowbridge's chit."
"Very well. Take care,"
she admonished gaily.
"You're looking very unslept this morning. You'll be needing a nice physic. My dead niece Julia, she had that look about her too."
Lance took the loaf and wine bottle full of water, his eggs and his stick, and navigated the doorway. "Your physic enough," he said, but not out loud. He edged his way up the dark, creaking stairway next to the saddle shop and set his burdens down while he manipulated the key. The establishment of Simon Barrowbridge, barrister, consisted primarily of a large room with a half-partition. On the entrance side of this were a stool, a settle, and 2 wooden chairs, with a small writing shelf built into the partition. On the far side was a monstrous desk, a clerk's table and high stool, and 1 straight chair, 4 defendants.
Barrowbridge used to say, the assumption being that plaintiffs would be strong enough to stand. One large window pierced the wall directly behind the desk, and it had been literally years before Lance had realized its function in keeping Barrowbridge's leonine, pockmarked head in mighty silhouette while light flooded the faces of his interlocutors. Books covered the walls from floor to ceiling behind the partition, except for one narrow doorway at the rear, which was framed by them. From the other side of this doorway, as Lance entered and turned back for his supplies, came a series of animal chokes, wheezes, gasps, whistles, grunts, and sneezes, all of which he ignored. He closed the door and quietly stepped to the writing shelf, where he took a sheet of foolscap and heavy marking lead, and lettered busily for a moment, "No consultations today," and under it in flowing script, "Simon Barrowbridge." This he took outside and pinned to the stair landing, where the dim glow from an air hole would fall on it, and returned to the office. He locked the door as silently as the clumsy iron would permit, and started the fire which had been laid, courtesy of Milord Scuttle, the evening before. He filled the kettle and put it on, looking with distaste at the grey drippings from the iron skillet, shrugged and put it on too to receive the eggs. All the while the gurglings, snifflings, snufflings, and half-aspirated whistlings continued from the rear door. At last he went to it and flung it open.
"Good morning, Mr. Barrowbridge, sir."
The room was small, the bed huge. The man who lay on it, curled and dangerous like a wounded bear, glowered at him.
"Damn it, Pickett, didn't you hear me? Or are you trying not to? Slide me yon chamber like a good chap."
The convenience in question stood on a closed cabinet in an ancient sideboard by the door. Lance did not even glance in its direction.
"Another warm day, sir."
The great hulk shifted ominously.
"I made a rather simple request, Egger Pickett."
Barrowbridge's voice was not a voice, or barely a voice at all. It was a rasping whisper, edgy, painful to hear, and doubtless painful to produce. Lance said,
"Mother Starch had some plover's eggs. I'll have them for you directly, sir."
Barrowbridge thrashed and heaved until he was sitting up.
"By gad, sir, I'll get it myself, then,"
and reached for his chair. His chair was a heavy and richly carved structure, probably one of the few really fine things the old barrister now owned. When placed behind his enormous desk in the other room, it appeared to be an ordinary chair. It was not. It was equipped with 4-inch oak wheels, the two rear ones skillfully mounted on casters. With these and a heavy walking stick to scull with, the old man could get around these two rooms with surprising deftness. When he reached for the chair this time, however, it darted away from his grasp and fled to Lance, who had hooked the rug between the front legs with his toe. With an urbane smile, he pulled the chair through the door and put it neatly in place behind the desk. The kettle had begun to sing. Lance ignored the whispered roars from the other room, as if they were so much distant surf, and went to find the teapot. As he bent to knock out the old leaves, he glanced back and saw the old man taking his heavy cudgel from its resting place by the small window and laying it alongside the outside edge of the bed, just covered by the edge of his greasy old comforter. Lance rinsed out the pot from the water bottle, and then filled it with boiling water from the kettle. He put on the lid and covered it with a cosy.
"Last night was a great success, sir," he said conversationally. "I think Lady Blanton was pleased with me. She asked me back. Beauclerc was there too, but left early from that dashed club of his. What a man of that Finnish seas and a grubby lot of hacks and actors. Garrick and Goldsmith and that lot I cannot imagine."
He lifted the edge of the tea cosy and touched the pot briefly with his fingertips.
"How can I ever repay you for what you've done?" he asked warmly. "All night long I lay and thought of you, sir, and my great debt to you. You took me from the muck and grime of the stables. You taught me to speak. You taught me law. You have wangled invitations and introductions for me I could never have had. That I never would have thought you could manage. Yet you've done it. How can I repay you? How could I ever begin?
The choked whisper had a suggestion about a piece of furniture, but he ignored it, concentrating on the outside temperature of the teapot. At last it seemed to satisfy him, and he emptied its hot water carefully into the bottle and threw in the tea, filled it from the kettle, replaced cover and cozy, and set it aside to steep. The skillet was all a crackle now, and he broke two eggs into it and contemplated them.
Lady Blanton asked me, just as I was leaving, if I thought it quite proper for her to have a rather notorious guest in her house. I answered her as you would have, sir, speaking a great deal and committing myself to nothing at all. I must say I was proud of myself, but prouder still of you. It was like having you invisible there at my elbow, whispering to me from the weight of your years and experience.
The spate of words carried him to the door, where he leaned gracefully, smiling. Barrowbridge had for the moment given up trying to speak. Only because he was watching for it did Lance see the slight motion at the edge of the bed as the barrister's hand tightened on the concealed stick. The bulge of the monstrous shoulder. Barrowbridge's legs were useless, with scrofula and gout, but those shoulders and heavy arms were to be treated with respect. Lance smiled with his respectful smile and turned away, just out of range. He crossed to the teapot, took down a clean cup, poured a few drops of tea, looked at its color, nodded, and poured it full. He sprinkled in a few granules of sugar, lifted the cup, and carried it carefully to the back room. He stepped inside, so swiftly and smoothly, and swung the cup and saucer with his own momentum so carefully that not a drop spilled as he presented the cup an inch before the old man's startled face. Years of intimate association had taught him how very much Barrowbridge appreciated the first draught of that first cup of tea in the morning. As the pocked nostrils dilated over the steaming cup, Lance bent slightly and twitched the stick away. It clattered to the floor far behind him, in the outer office, like a spent arrow. Barrowbridge's jaw dropped as he followed it longingly with his eyes.
"My goodness," said Lance, half to himself, gazing into the depths of the cup. "Not strong enough after all."
And cup and all retreated to the office. The sound Barrowbridge made, had he his own great bugle of a voice, would have been a wordless scream. It issued ludicrously as a sort of yawn, though. Lance busied himself with the eggs, dipping them out of the skillet onto an earthenware plate. He cut the bread and arranged it around the eggs, and stood a moment to admire the effect. When he reached the door with the plate, Barrowbridge seemed about to weep. Lance stopped, startled. He had never seen this before.
"My dear sir," he exclaimed. "What in the name of God's got into you, Lanky? What are you doing to me?"
"I? Why, sir, you are my benefactor, Mr. Barrowbridge. I would never..."
He laughed deprecatingly and made a slight gesture with the plate of food.
"Doing to you, sir? Perhaps preparing a small something to break your fast. Perhaps you don't care for plover's eggs?" he added worriedly.
"Get me the night mug,"
said the man brokenly, pointing at the sideboard.
"Get me a bite to eat, and then, for the love of heaven, sit down and tell me what's gotten into you."
"Oh, I've been thoughtless. I've..."
And Lance hurried to the sideboard. He opened the cabinet briskly, took out the chamber, averted his head, lifted the lid, and let the contents of the plate, bread, eggs, and all, slip into it. He met the barrister's horror-struck eyes.
"Oh, how thoughtless of me!" murmured Lance contritely. "And careless! How can you ever forgive me?"
He then replaced the cover, lifted the object back to the sideboard.
"Lanky!"
wailed the old man as it disappeared and firmly closed its door.
"I beg you an instant's patience, and I'll have more eggs for you,"
said Lance earnestly, and fairly ran to prepare them. While the eggs were cooking, he went back to lean in the doorway. Barrowbridge was lying back again, eyes closed now.
"An interesting matter of law came to my attention last night," Lance said,
apparently looking at his fingernails, but actually watching the closed eyes on the bed. They opened, red and agonized.
"And it came to me that if anyone might be able to solve it, you could."
"Do you think I can talk law at a time like this?"
"I think you could talk law at any time, anywhere," said Lance, in tones of pure idolatry.
"Think again," said Barrowbridge, and closed his eyes.
"It is the matter," said Lance precisely, "of Elizabeth Chudleigh and her desired marriage to the second Duke of Kingston."
All that was puffy, fluid, soft, malleable, and subject to change in that massive old face seemed in an instant to disappear, and in its place was a rock carving. The head even sank a little deeper into the pillow, as if it had acquired a new dead weight.
For a long, breathless moment, nothing happened. Nothing moved.
It was a stasis, following which anything, literally anything, might have happened, provided only that it was explosive. And the explosion came in the simple, unbelievable fact that there was none. Barrowbridge opened his eyes and looked at his young protege and sighed. Softly, gently, barely a breath, and then whispered,
"So that's it."
Weakly, he tried and failed to wet his lips with the tip of his greyish tongue.
"I might have known, I might have seen. This is the kind of thing she does so well. What did she do, Lanky? Draw you out until she had all my weaknesses before her, and then rehearse you?"
"You do me little credit, sir."
"Ah, do I, though? Well, friend bastard, and I speak precisely because you are, to be sure, I shall not help her, now or at any time in the future. You may faithfully believe this yourself, and you may convey the conviction to your new owner."
"But, sir..."
"Oh,
I've let the oaks cook hard. Ah, Mr. Barrowbridge, there's a haunting on your breakfast. Never mind, sir. I've still 2 more eggs, but I'd best eat these myself. You taught me yourself to waste nothing. I'll be quick, sir. Bear with me."
He put the eggs on the plate where the new bread awaited it, drew up the clerk's high stool to the corner of the big desk that could be seen from the bedroom, fetched the cooling cup of tea he had poured earlier, and composed himself to eat. There was no other sound from the other room. He sipped the tea thoughtfully. He was considerate and did not smack his lips. With the staccato entry of voice upon swallow, he said,
"I saw your notice on the landing, sir. Why do you want no consultations today? Why, anyone who comes will turn away without even reaching the door."
No answer. Lance cut away egg with his knife and carefully laid the ivory and gold silver upon a piece of bread. He brought it carefully to his mouth and filled it. He ruminated for long enough, swallowed, sipped tea, and said informatively,
"Nice little beggar, that scuttle. Since we're seeing no clients today, I sent him off to see the gypsies with a silver 3-penny. He'll not be in until tomorrow."
Still nothing. Lance wagged his head admiringly. The old chap was tough, or unconscious at this point. He glanced quickly at the red glare and nodded. Tough was the word.
"Mr. Barrowbridge, I am here in your service and prepared to discuss law with you. If you would prefer to be alone, I will, as always, oblige you."
He hurriedly ate up the rest of the egg and bread and drank the tea down. Then he turned to the open doorway and made an inquisitive sound, raising his eyebrows a great deal and his shoulders a little in the manner attributed to Lord Chesterfield. Barrowbridge, deep in the pillow, nodded.
"Get out, then!"
Lance sighed and rose. Crossing and recrossing the office, he got his hat and coat and stick. He tidily lifted the kettle from the fireplace and set it on the hearth, poked up the fire and added a stick or two, covered the bread against flies, sighed again and went to the door. The door could not be seen from the bedroom. He unlocked it and swung it wide.
"Goodbye, sir."
No answer. Lance stepped over the sill and down on the creaking board which for 11 years had loudly marked every passage in and out of this room. He then stepped back inside again, soft as a cat, and slammed the door. Noisily he locked it. He then employed two artifices he had been taught by a thief whom Barrowbridge had once defended. One was to bend swiftly and pound the floor with the hottest part of the heels of his hands, in imitation of departing footsteps. The other device was a method of breathing silently in concealment. So there he crouched, head back, mouth open like an idiot watching the moon, fingertips on the floor for balance, his very soul in his ears. He waited until his left foot was an agony of pins and needles, and his right was cold. Nothing. Nothing. Finally, a faint sequence of sounds, hushed bleats, a sudden mighty thrashing in a series of labored syllables. A muffled crash that set the floorboards jumping, and over the sound of a mulling iron plunged into cool ale. With a single motion, Lance shucked out of hat and coat and bounded to the inner door to be leaning against it, his sleek head on one side, watching with cool curiosity the great broken mound of a man on the bedroom floor, one useless leg still lying across the bed and the other on the floor, the stub-clawed hands spraddling and crab-creeping across toward the sideboard, nostrils a-quiver, inflating, a shiver collapsing, while lips and nostrils in unison gave forth that great reiterated hiss. Caught up in his own misery, Barrowbridge had obviously let it fill his cosmos, and crept and grovelled and slobbered for many seconds before he was aware of the spectator, and then only as a boot in the doorway. He stopped, breathing abruptly, for a heartbeat, and then, actually, reached out and touched Lance's foot with wandering, wet fingers. Then, unable to raise himself high enough to look upward, he made a single great convulsion, turned over, presenting his great big head to Lance's fascinated gaze, upside down, contorted. The brute's log of a leg slipped off the bed then, and Lance knew somehow that its bolt of pain broke what had been brought to the breaking point.
"Ah, then, ah,"
he soothed like a nurse with a babe.
"Did he fall then, did he? Ah, no. You're all right then. Just let me make you better, you poor thing."
His words ceased to be words, just a gentling, as he settled the head on the floor and straightened the legs, cut a purchase on the sideboard, and heaved the shuddering trunk erect, so that Barrowbridge sat on the floor, as uncertain and in all parts as a 10-week-old infant. Barrowbridge complied like one, helpless in the young man's hands, passive beyond distrust. It was a long while and a mighty job of work before the barrister was comforted and restored to his couch, combed and cleaned, the bed remade, and at last the cup of tea steaming at hand. By then it was Lance who looked the part of the beaten one, that is, until one saw his face. Barrowbridge had ceased his gasping, or sobbing, if that's what it was, for the time being, and lay dully watching Lance work. The first thing he said was all but inaudible, and he had to repeat it twice before Lance understood.
"I must sleep now."
"Surely, surely," said Lance. "But you'll answer my question first."
Barrowbridge moved his head from side to side. It was not a negation, but an expression of weakness, of incapability.
"Come now," Lance urged in his most penetrating sotto, accompanied by his most thrumming bass. "I want you to rest, and rest you shall. I'll watch over you and take care of you. I want no explanations.
those I can find for myself. Ah, dear friend, how many times I've seen you sum up a thick brief with a word of advice. Remember Richards with the ship-lading action. Plead guilty, you said, and Oxham, a shout away from the gallows. Two wives and an unfulfilled indenture. Emigrate, you said. Give me such a word for Miss Chudley, sir, then you shall sleep.
Boroughbridge flapped his lips weakly and said a word. It needed saying a number of times. Even a familiar one becomes meaningless if repeated often enough, but this one would have been meaningless to him if it had not been clearly tattooed on his kneecap.
Jactation, he said at last.
The barrister nodded and astonishingly smiled. There was an odd anticipation in the smile, and when Lance began to rise to plunge into the book racks in the office, the old man caught his sleeve. With what seemed to be his last atom of energy, he nodded to the right of the door, smiled again, and before Lance's eyes, slept. Slowly, Lance rose and went to the book racks, turning in amazement to his right instead of his left, where the old man's great library of law had most of its body. Surely in these thousands of pages lay his answer. But no. The glance to his right, and that old smile of triumph in his skill, indicated that it was to be found in the Esoterica, the little-used collection of what Boroughbridge sometimes jocosely called uncommon law. Lance began to read.